Welcome back to Find the Zen Within. My name is Jack Register, and I am your host. Our podcast is an anger management podcast for men, where men gather together to talk about issues of anger and how anger shows up in our lives and what we might do about it. Today, we actually have a wonderful guest, friend of mine, Mr. David Berger, who is with us today to talk about what does anger mean in his work and what does it look like from his point of view. So without further ado, David, good morning. It's good to be with you today. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what do you do in the world?
Well, good morning. I am by trade a high school English teacher and have been there for about 30 plus years. I teach English mostly to advanced classes like AP and IB. And I am also an author.
Great.
Of fantasy fiction and poetry.
And I'll say, I'm a big fan of David's work. His books are really incredible and they are wonderful. So I'm just going to put a plug in there. We'll let you know later on in the podcast about how you can actually find his work. I really adore his writing. So David, why is this topic, anger management around teens and youth, important in your work?
Well, being, like I said, being a teacher and being around teenagers from usually 14 or 15 up through 17 or 18, behavior is a major part of the learning process. Students can't learn or be in a good learning environment when they are experiencing emotions like anger and frustration and anxiety. So understanding how they do what they do and why they do what they do helps my job even beyond teaching about writing and reading literature.
Great, great. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. What have you seen that has surprised you with this population in regards to anger? You had talked before a little bit about the posturing that you might see from students whenever they're frustrated. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, it's students don't always have the ability to vocalize like adults might have because they haven't been through enough experiences or they haven't had the training or the role modeling from parents or people at home. So they do this posturing where they may use body language or they would, you know, slam a pen down or act in a certain way that shows microaggressions that would signal that there's something else going on that they may not be able to vocalize. And sometimes that can also be the warning sign of a slow build to something that could in effect happen later in the day, later in that class period. It just depends on how safe that particular student feels, because I think students will act out in an environment where they know they feel safe enough that someone will take care of them and make sure that they are okay and those around them are okay.
So what, that's a really important point that you just brought up. So on a daily basis, do you think that part of your responsibility as a teacher and helper is to create the safe space so that students can really be their authentic self?
Well, I think that's part of what I have to do in the classroom. It's not just about the curriculum, because people of all ages can't learn if they don't feel comfortable and safe and willing to take risks. And in this case, students who are very much into the I don't want to be wrong mentality and look foolish in front of their peers, they don't want to seem as if they are unable to answer a question or look somewhat knowledgeable in front of their classmates. So this also fosters a frustration and an anger when students see other people around them in the classroom, for example, who are at a higher level. There are students who come into my room from all walks of life, even in an advanced class, and there's always that bell curve. Someone, you know, some are on the lower end, some are in the middle, and then some are on the higher end. And those who tend to be on the lower end of that bell curve get frustrated because they are not where their peers are and maybe wonder why didn't they get the same experience or why weren't they afforded the same opportunity and might start getting angry at maybe prior teachers for not teaching them the things that their classmates are, you know, seemingly have an easier time addressing. So anger and frustration and always appears throughout the day, even when we're not even aware that it's actually there outwardly. It's always, I think, for some of them, under the surface.
It makes a lot of sense. Do you think that anger and bullying are connected at all?
I do. I think that bullies are people who have, in my opinion, have self-esteem issues, and they only do what they do because they want to have power over others. And they are compensating for a lack of something in their lives, so it's easier to just lash out and deflect, you know, to other people, whether it be because of students' physical appearance, it could be because of their intelligence or their ability, it could be because being LGBT, it could be for anything. And the bullying that we see mostly is online through social media. We don't see it as much physically in the classroom or in the hallways as much as we used to, because now students can do it through anonymous means, through their TikToks or Instagram, or even through texting. So there's ways that students can bully in ways that parents and teachers aren't always aware that it's happening until sometimes it gets to be too late. And others, the ones who are being bullied, are the ones who act out themselves because they don't feel they can tell adults or other people in their lives what's actually happening. They don't want to look weaker, and they'd rather try to handle it themselves. And there is a percentage of that, unfortunately, where that bullying leads to self-harm and even suicide.
Right, right. That's a really important point. So I want to make sure that we say to listeners that if you are listening to this podcast and you are struggling with or having any questions around harming yourself or thoughts of suicide, the National Suicide Hotline is an incredible resource that's available through the text of 988. And if you're an LGBT youth who's actually listening to this podcast and you're struggling with the same issues or struggling in general with being seen or heard or understood, the Trevor Project is another amazing resource nationally that is available. David, what kind of training do teachers have around anger issues with students?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have specific trainings geared toward that as an individual subject. We learn about basically behavior through a system of the steps process that we have to take when we encounter a student who is misbehaving. So we start out by talking to the student, or then we're told to involve the parents and then the counselors, and in some cases, administration. But there is no training on dealing with anger issues in particular. And only when a student has that in their past, perhaps from other classes or just part of a 504 or an IEP, a special plan that's put in place for students' needs, sometimes that will come up and we are given advice or techniques on how to handle that. But unfortunately, it's just not something that we on the daily are, you know, instructed to do. And it doesn't even come up all that often unless the student has shown that kind of behavior, and then we deal with it as it happens, because it's just something that I guess isn't part of the teacher trainings, except for things like curriculum or dealing with classroom management as a whole. I wish there were more anger-specific trainings given, because we don't understand, or many adults have forgotten, what it's like to be teenagers and understand that, yes, we were angry at some things that we didn't have the ability to understand at the time, or the means to rise above and get beyond. And especially, like we'd said, if you are in a group of people, whether you're a person of color, whether you're a woman, or whether you're LGBT, when you have other issues that could be affecting you, we as teachers are not trained in how to deal with that specifically, which is, I think, a sad part of our educational system that should definitely be addressed.
That's a really important point. When you're interacting with families and parents, do you ever find that you start to see some of the seeds of the anger that your students are experiencing, or you start to have an awareness that perhaps part of what's going on with your student is something related to the family that they may not necessarily even be aware of?
Sometimes we do have that, you know, that adage that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And sometimes you can see when the parents come in, just how they are is a direct correlation to the student. They have learned behaviors and learned techniques from their parents that are destructive, that are disrespectful. So in that case, we have to try to work with the parent as well as the student and try to diffuse situations and explain how we as teachers and administrators and counselors have to handle what happens in the school or in the classroom or in the locker room or wherever these events happen. And sometimes we have parents who are the opposite. the parents have been super supportive. They have been in contact with teachers and other personnel at the school, but for some reason, their child is choosing to act out. And then that's when we start to talk about all of the things within that child's life to see, is it job related? Is it home related? Maybe they just moved. Maybe the parents have been divorced or are going through difficult times. Maybe there's a sibling issue. There's all sorts of things that factor in, but I think parents have a unique position, not just as parenting their children, but also when you're dealing with a student in school, because they have to consider that there are other variables that affect their kids. It's not just, you can't just blame your son or daughter for behavior when there are other people, peers, teachers, and everybody else that those students interact with, that could be the reason why that child is acting that way. And it may have nothing to do with the home life at all. So it just depends. And that's where we have to suss out the situation and ask the right questions without lighting a fuse with the parents and just trying to figure out what is the home life like. And sometimes you can tell right away. Sometimes the parents come in already bearing to fight. And sometimes the parents are the exact opposite. And they're like, we don't know what's happening. This is how our home is. And we can't figure out why our child is acting this way. So right. That's when we have to kind of ask the right questions, look at all the behaviors of everybody, and then try to come up with a plan.
So it sounds like we're really just trying to hold space for the student as they are, regardless, and try and really be that village, as another old adage goes, that it does really take a village to raise a child, so that we can all be present to their needs and help them learn how to show up differently. When a situation happens with a student after an angry experience, what's the process? You had talked before a little bit about that there's sort of an immediate response and then sort of a school systemic response and then some staff support. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. My experiences, when I've heard from other teachers or even with my own classes, when a student's anger comes out through physical means, verbal means, both, or even just we notice that there's something in it through those microaggressions in the classroom, the first thing that we tend to try to do is address the student first. Find a safe space, a safe time. I would never just address the student in front of the whole class, because they would feel, even if I pulled them to the side of the room, other people are watching. So we find a time, hopefully, when the student is willing to come back and talk and try to deal with it that way first, because it could be something that's easily diffusible, or it could be a misunderstanding on the student's part, or it could be something that they've tried to deal with a teacher outside the classroom of mine, and they've been unsuccessful. So sometimes that can be what helps. After that, though, if those behaviors continue and it becomes more destructive, either self-destructive or other, then we have to deal with getting the parents involved. That's usually the next step in the process. And we're always asked to do that first before we bring in an administrator or a counselor. That being said, if we happen to know, because we get flagged for students who may have behavioral issues early in the year, if we know that a counselor or a school psychologist or a behavioral specialist is tied to that student in some way, we might also bring them in and contact them to meet, and because they may already have a relationship made with that student and maybe plans were put in place, certain processes that they've already established, you know, with the student to say, okay, well, when this happens, what did we talk about that you do and how do you respond? Sometimes students have that in place. And then beyond that, if it gets to be more destructive or if the student is just not responding to those things, we will bring in an assistant principal or the principal to see what consequences for behavior, because that may often be the only other thing we can do is put in a consequence if a student has hurt another student verbally or physically or destroyed, you know, school property or things like that, where we've done everything we can. Beyond that, it depends on the student, but if things don't stop and their things are getting much worse in escalation, students are sometimes removed from the school environment, usually through out-of-school suspension or some other situation with an out-of-school personnel, so they can be assessed. Maybe they need more, you know, student might need hospitalization. We don't know. It just depends on the escalation of that particular student's needs.
Right. It seems like teachers' jobs are much more complicated than anybody would really think about in terms of the day-to-day sort of experiences that you have of really trying to keep everybody on track with learning and trying to also be a support and trying to manage the 30 or 40 different personalities that you've got going on at the same time as you're leading them through, just trying to teach them about whatever the subject is at hand, or in your case, the particular piece of literature. You and I have talked in the past a little bit about your work around LGBT youth in particular. Do you see anger issues affecting those folks in any particular sort of way?
I've seen frustration, anxiety, and anger manifest in those situations quite a bit, especially over the past couple of years, because of policies that have been put in place by the governor of my state. And there are situations that students already felt, even in the best of circumstances, even in a supportive environment, students do also feel that sense of they're retreating into themselves because they can't speak about their experiences if they don't have anyone around them, peers or adults, that they feel they can trust. There's always going to be that overwhelming emotional response. And when you have no other recourse but to keep it in, unfortunately, those behaviors leach out some other way, whether it be snapping back at teachers or peers, whether it be doing microaggressions physically or other things within the classroom. But I have seen with a lot of LGBTQ kids who do not have support from their families, they tend to attach themselves to their peers or teachers. I have a very safe space version of my classroom, also being openly gay with my students, and they understand that I am one of them. They understand I am part of their world, and I have gone through what they've gone through. And by talking to them about that sometimes even helps, realizing, oh, wait, someone has gone through what I'm dealing with right now. Maybe they can be someone I can lean toward. And a lot of students will come to me and just vent. They will vent about whatever's going on in their lives, whether it be, you know, academically related too, but also with relationships of peers or significant other they may have, or parents or somebody else. So anger is certainly not the only issue that they deal with, but it certainly becomes that when they feel like they have no one who will listen to them or to give them an opportunity to lean on them.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. It's really important that those of us who are a part of the community and in that role of elder show up for folks, because we didn't really have those kinds of things when we were young. Not that David and I are over the hill by any means, but we grew up in a very different era in terms of what it was like to be an LGBT youth. And I am just really thankful that we actually have out teachers. I actually don't remember meeting an out person until I was well into adulthood. And I think my life would have been much different had I known somebody whenever I was in high school. What is the main message you really want listeners to understand about how your life as a teacher and an author and whatnot shows up, and how you support folks who are kind of becoming and dealing with issues around anger and just life in general in 2024? What is a message you have for folks?
Well, I think for all people is to be good listeners. One thing I've noticed is that people like to talk, but they don't always like to listen. And you can say you're listening, but all you're doing is hearing the words go into your brain, but you're not really listening with the intent of understanding. And as a teacher specifically, you do have to listen to students, all their words, and listen to what they're saying, their tone of voice, their body language, and understand people. So rather than just saying, oh, that's he's just being a teenager, she's just acting out because, you know, it's her age or hormones or whatever the reason they want. If you actually take the moment to listen and observe, you'll see that there are more things going on beneath the surface, just like an iceberg. The things we see are only minimal compared to what's going on underneath. The inner turmoil, the inner self-loathing, the inner rejection that we give ourselves when we don't get some of the things we would like to see in the world around us. Just be observant, because if you start judging, especially young people, for their behavior and blame it on their age, that's not fair, because right. I know a lot of students, teenagers and even younger than that, who actually have the maturity or the beginnings of a good mature foundation to understand the world. And we can't just put a blanket over everything and say, well, this is the situation. And so we just have to look at it that way. We do have to be open-minded to that and also be willing to find ways to incrementally help people, not give them a ladder where the rungs are so far apart that they can't climb it. We need to give them the steps they need, whether they're smaller or bigger, to get out of that situation the best they can and to nurture that. There is no time frame. You can't say we have to solve this in an hour or a day or a week. It takes as long as it takes. And patience, understanding, compassion, these are things that should be a part of people who are trying to help those who deal with anger issues, whether they be teenagers or not.
I appreciate you sharing that. You and I had talked before about one of the ways that you deal with issues of just trying to rebalance yourself and whatnot is to find happy places and escapes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, for me personally, I mean, as an older adult now that I've gone through enough of life, happy places have been those places for me physically and mentally that have helped keep me grounded, whether it be a place I visited in my youth that was a specific location where I felt the happiest because I had maybe the least issues to worry about at the time, or I was a place where I felt, you know, loved and accepted. Or it could be like my office, which is currently surrounded by a lot of Wonder Woman art and imagery and all of what that embodies for me. I think that happy places, physical ones you can visit, and also ones in your mind, become, these are things that people can't take away from you, basically. They can't remove those associations. And so when we're struggling, happy places like that are good. Whether if you can't go to a physical location, then go in your mind to a place where you felt the happiest. And yeah, it may be a childhood memory, but there's nothing wrong with, even as an older adult, going back to a place when you were, you know, in your single digit years, when you can remember being at your grandparents' house or being with your parents or at a certain amusement park or wherever it was. Those are important for helping us find foundations and grounding us and anchoring us into the positive feelings. And by using those feelings, sometimes we can use those to climb over some of the harder negative situations and sort of dominate that through positivity and good memories and good associations instead of the bad ones.
Right, right. Thank you so much, David. This has been an amazing conversation. So the last thing I want to do is to ask you about where can folks find your writing and tell us a little bit about your books?
Well, basically you can find a lot of things, most things about my writing at davidbergerbooks.com. And my writing includes fantasy novels, specifically poetry and short fiction. And I tend to bring the fantasy world into my own through largely mythology, like Greek mythology, Celtic mythology, because those were places, as we talked about, the happy places were being in certain books for me were the happy places. And visiting those fantastical, fictional places in my mind was what kept me happiest when I was, you know, struggling through my parents' divorce or being a, you know, a teenager and dealing with those issues and closeted teenager as well. So that's what you can find, where you can find my writing. I also have put out, and I'm putting out a second one, but an anthology of short fiction and poetry that some of it ties to mythology, but some of it also ties to personal experience. And it's an ability for me to express emotions and situations that I've dealt with that might resonate with other people as well. Specifically being a gay man, other people who are LGBT should also be able to, I would hope, connect with some of those pieces of work that I've put out there.
I really appreciate you sharing your time with us today. Again, my name is Jack Register, and I am the host of your podcast. If you're interested in finding more about what the Finding Zen Within community is about, we actually have a Facebook page by the same name, and you can also find out more on my website, jack-register.com. So please look us up. If you're interested in being a part of the podcast, we actually have a be a guest form on the podcast website itself that you just need to complete and have a chat with me, and then we will get you on. We want to grow and have a bigger conversation with folks about how anger is showing up in the world and affecting the lives of men and the people who love us, and how we can actually have a true beloved community and come together in different ways. David, thank you so much for your time today. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.